Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we're here to talk between seasons 10 and 11 about another profiling-related piece of fiction, this time the book and TV miniseries, The Alienist, which is available on Netflix. Well, it was when we recorded this a year ago, but hopefully it's still available now.
Yeah. And if it's not, you'll find it somewhere.
It's not hard to find. I mean, it's...
Yeah, things show up on YouTube after they're off Netflix.
Yeah, and I mean, most things can be rented somewhere. That's what iTunes is for. Okay. But yes, this is based on Caleb Carr's book from, what, 1998, 1999?
Well, let me double check.
She's got a copy of the book right there.
I actually went and pulled my copy and made sure it was in front of me.
It's so actually... you're good to go. Nice.
1994.
Oh my God, I was way off.
Yeah, and the paperback was 95.
Okay. So yeah, but Caleb Carr, he wrote this book about unrealistically forward-thinking psychologists at the turn of the century New York and them trying to catch a serial killer. And it's a fun ride. I mean, I remember enjoying the book back in the day, back when you gave me your copy years and years and years ago to read. And I read your copy and had a good time with it. And that is this copy you still have to this day.
Yes, battered and whatever. Like, I'm looking at it and I'm going...
24-year-old book. It's
really battered.
Well, it's a 24-year-old book. It's just a paperback. Those things aren't built to last. It's not like, you know, leather-bound editions with heavily glued spines. Like, these things are not meant to last. So it's kind of a miracle that it has.
Yeah. And I don't even think I bought it secondhand.
Wow. So way to go.
I mean, often yes, I buy a lot of books.
Oh, no, yes. Obviously. We love the used bookshop. Ottawa has a chain of bookstores, or Eastern Ontario has a chain of bookstores called... What is it? The Book Market?
Yeah. And,
it is a whole chain of just really musty, dusty buildings, just packed to the gills with books. And if you're ever in Eastern Ontario, look them up. And it is a statement to how long it took for, you know, the culture to change and for people's priorities to change, that the Book Market in downtown Ottawa. So this is the capital city of a... decently large country. I mean, the second biggest country in the world, but a decently large population country. And right at the core of the downtown was just like this two-story building packed with books.
Yeah.
And I always loved that about it.
Oh, well, yeah. And then there were the places with the videos. I mean, there are still outliers there. Like, you can't get a decent secondhand book in Sault Ste. Marie, for example. You have to go to what, Value Village?
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and then they're not. Anyway, but you can go to Toronto, and there are lots of them. Like on Dundas in the Junction, for example, there are two or three. And they're the old style bookstores. Like, they're stacked up, you know, 10 feet high, 12 feet high, and they're stacked on the floor around, and you have to go scrounging through them. They're sort of organized, but not.
That is my favorite experience of shopping for books. So yeah, if you were here to hear us talk about used bookstores, you've come to the right place. But I guess we should start talking about Caleb Carr and The Alienist, which, as I said, is I remember really enjoying the book. I haven't read it in 24 years, so I can't say if the book's any good, but I do remember really enjoying it when I first read it. Hopefully you can tell me whether I'm right to have enjoyed it or not.
Oh, yeah. No. The book, in fact, if I was to say anything right now, well, first of all, I don't think it's as science fiction-y as you would, as you indicated.
Well, no. I'm just saying that the prevailing attitudes about personality construction that underline the entire premise of the book did not come into popular... I mean, and the thing is, he is a rebel.
He is
developing these ideas. Yes.
Yeah, this guy is kind of developing, and nobody accepts them.
I'm just saying it's basically the steampunk equivalent of psychology, where someone has technology in it, where the whole premise of steampunk is some technology from, you know, very far in the future is being, you know, used with the machines of the past. Like, so what if people had invented computers back when we just had steam is the basic idea underlying the whole thing. And I'm saying that's the version of psychology. It's like, what if this guy came along and at a time when people were still worried about humors, was thinking of the actual ways that human personality develops?
Well, the thing is, no, but the thing is that this is the time, because the book is placed and the TV series is placed in the late 19th century.
Yeah.
Right? Where Teddy Roosevelt hasn't become president yet.
Yeah, no.
Right? Just when he's in New York.
Yeah, when he's running the police department in New York.
Yeah, and these three people, the three key people, so the guy that becomes the psychologist and the newspaper guy and Teddy Roosevelt were friends at Harvard.
Yes.
Right? So they were just always friends. But this is the time when William James is just starting. Mm-hmm. This is the time when Freud, now that's interesting because they do bring up Freud's changing his mind.
Yes, which I really enjoyed.
In the book, like, you don't get any of that in the TV
series. No, that has all been left out of this TV series, which made me a little sad.
There are a number of things in the TV series that I found problematic.
Oh, let's get to that. But first, we should probably explain the plot. Someone is murdering children in New York City. And prostitutes, yes.
Child prostitutes.
Child prostitutes in New York City. And they're always male, and they're always put in high places and brutalized in really horrific ways.
Yeah.
And so this is obviously, and this is the whole premise of the book, which is basically everyone knows that this is a serial killer, but they don't have concept of that yet. Because the only serial killer that has existed, because what year is the book set? 1896. 1896. So the only serial killer people have ever heard of at this point is Jack the Ripper. Mm-hmm. Like, that is the only thing that exists in people's mind up to this point.
Yeah.
Ergo, they assume something like that is happening here, but let's not forget, they didn't catch Jack the Ripper.
That's right. And the thing with this one is that politically, they just want to hide it. And it doesn't matter because these are child prostitutes. They are living in the tenements. I mean, the book gives you a really good, like, if you can visualize what you read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of just the horrors of New York City during that period.
Yeah. It's a kind of poverty that is hard for city dwellers today to wrap their heads around.
Yeah.
Like, it is, I mean, obviously, I'm talking about in, you know, North America, Western Europe. There is plenty of this part of the kind of poverty still existing in the world. I'm not delusional. But I'm just saying, someone who grew up in the 1980s, the idea of these packed together slums and narrow streets and people, you know, crammed together in these crazy ways just seems completely insane to me, but that was just how everybody in New York, except for the very wealthy, lived.
Yeah, and it's just what's interesting is that the closest you come to it is tenement living.
Yes.
Is the projects.
Yeah.
You know,
the housing projects that you know still exist in New York.
They weren't in Chicago and stuff. Chicago. Trying to clean them up, but
But even they were never as, you know, dense and cluttered and bleak as actual New York living was for, hundreds of years.
They didn't have plumbing and they didn't have any of those things, right? It was just, anyway, it is.
No, but that is one thing I do remember from the book is the visceral descriptions of that kind of New York. And it's a thing that the show attempts to do, but obviously, you cannot talk about the smell of things in a TV show.
No.
You can't get that across.
No. And what they didn't show were the sweepers, for example, that they had started to bring in to keep the streets clean.
Yes.
And but it's the violence of the police force, of course.
Oh, God. And that's something that the book does really well, as I remember. But the TV show only does a little the fact that, let's face it, at this time, and we can all have our debates about the value of the police force, but mm-hmm. at the time, 100%, the police force was just the most powerful gang in the city.
Yeah, that's all they were.
That's all they were. There is no other way to describe them. They were there to make money for themselves and to have a comfortable life and to beat up anyone who looked at them sideways. That's all the New York police force did. And people could make jokes about how that's still what the New York police force is like. And it's not crazy to say that that is, to a certain point, ingrained in their DNA. But there was no subtlety about it.
Yes. Like,
there was no professional standards to being in the New York Police Department at this point in history.
I was going to say, Tom Selleck notwithstanding.
Blue Bloods. Such a wonderful show.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. I'm not going to question Blue Bloods. But no, what it comes down to it is they were, and that's what, and that is what Ted Levine is playing in the TV show that I think he does such a good job of, is a guy who was the head of a gang for 30 years. Well, I mean, he worked his way up to be head of the gang, but he's like a prominent member of a gang, and he became the head of the gang for the last 10 years. He was in the gang, and now he's kind of retired, and you've got Teddy Roosevelt come in to try and, there's no better word to describe it, professionalize
and clean up the police force. And clean up,
yeah, to turn them into an actual public safety organization rather than just a gang of hooligans who have the color of law on their side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is something that the book I remember dealing with well, and you can correct me on this one, but I think the show does a pretty good job of it.
Oh yeah.
Especially because the book, because it's not an omnipotent narrator.
Yes, there's no omnipotent narrator
to the book, meaning you don't get a bunch of scenes with Ted Levine and the corrupt detective. And in the show, you get a bunch of scenes with Ted Levine and the corrupt detective. And it lets you see how, yes, Teddy Roosevelt is running things, but fundamentally, the cops are still going to their old boss for marching orders.
Yeah.
Because
slowly getting rid of the cops, and you don't see that. You see it much better, and you see a lot of the political stuff that's going on and the tough time he's having, even with his board, because he's not the head of the cops as such. Yeah. He's the head of the police board.
Yes.
And
the Byrne stuff they've
plays
adapted
a bigger
there.
Role too in the TV show, and I like, there are questions that I have about the TV show.
Right.
There are two main ones, and you may have forgotten.
I probably
sort of Sarah have. In the book. And I was really, I was unhappy about most things. I could understand why the changes were made to the script. But
what really troubled you?
The role of Sarah?
Yeah.
Because in the book, right, clearly, she is much more, she's more prominent.
Yep. She's got a much bigger part in the book. That I did remember. But what is the big character?
For example, when they go to see the first boy they have to deal with, the Santorelli boy.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first boy they have to deal with in the movie, they have when she goes with the reporter guy.
Yeah.
That's what I'll call him, right? Into visit the Santorellis, and the father has been beaten up.
Yeah.
Right? Completely. And so the wife looks at Sarah and says, you're here. Like, and she has to explain to the reporter that she had been going with a nurse. She had been spending her summers.
Yeah.
Apprenticing essentially with one of these nurses. And so this woman thinks that she's asked for the doctor, but she's the nurse.
Right.
And Sarah is the nurse, and Sarah actually speaks Italian. some Italian so she can understand her.
Yeah, she's already a and part of this world.
She's already a part of this world, but she also manages to calm everything down. She manages to find things, and she manages to do some healing for this guy, and she just does it right away. Yeah. Whereas in the TV show,
they have her
she's almost like she's not there. They think the man is the doctor, the reporter, and the reporter's going, what should I do? You know, and the rest of it, it just wasn't as effective as it was in the book.
Well, no, because they want her to be they want her to, like the reporter, be a member of the upper class who is discovering, you know, the horrible situations. And you're right, it's a better reversal if
But she is a member of the upper class.
No, but I'm saying yes. But in the show, she's just discovering these horrifying situations for the first time. But you're right, it's more, if that's how it's handled the book, I did not remember that part. Yeah. It's more effective if she is someone who has already been working with the poor and already understanding, you know, the horror of these situations that these people are living in and their circumstances. Yeah. And that way, we are seeing extra level, we are discovering through the reporter, the all of the extra levels this woman has that he didn't realize.
Yeah, and he's the one that's basically the narrator of the book.
And he's the one who's discovering all of this stuff.
The one who is just shocked and can't believe
it. And appalled that this is how people live.
Yeah, and so, of course, the boy that he sort of takes under his wing is murdered in the book and is not murdered in the...
Yeah, I found it a little weird that he isn't murdered in the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seems very strange that he's not murdered in the show when I feel like that kind of should have been.
Yeah.
It's integral to his development, especially because then at the end of the show, it's not like he's looking after that kid.
He should. If they wanted to leave him alive, then.
Yeah, then he's got to adopt this kid.
Yeah. And take care of him.
Yeah. Right? He's got to look after this kid. It's fine if you want to leave him alive, but if the reporter doesn't then look after the kid, well, you've got a really weird message coming through. Mm-hmm.
that I didn't understand at all. This guy hasn't really learned anything. The reporter hasn't really learned anything.
Yeah, because if the kid is killed, then he can have learned things and learned about the tragedy and want to do better in the future. But if the kid isn't killed and he doesn't look after him, well, what lesson have you really learned?
Yeah. And the strange thing, of course, in the book, and there's no reason not to leave that out, is that this boy reminds him of his brother.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, some changes are effective. Like, I think having Stevie pretend, right?
Yes.
To be a prostitute, that was an effective thing.
Yeah.
You know, I thought.
Where you lose Stevie as bait. That did work in the show.
It worked in the show. It's not on the book, in the book, but it does work in the show. And I think that, it's almost as if the psychiatrist I felt far more uncomfortable with him in the show than I did in the book.
He's a very creepy and intense, and it's weird because when you find out what happened with his dad, you get why he is this way, right? But he is a much more creepy and intense figure in the show than he ever came across to me in the book.
Yeah, he's creepy.
He's very intense and he's very unsettling and he pushes people in uncomfortable ways.
Okay.
In a way that he just doesn't in the book.
Okay, and I have to ask you something else.
Please.
Okay, why did they change when they talk about the fight?
Yeah.
Right? That Roosevelt and the psychiatrist, I can never remember his name now.
I know. Kreitzler.
I'll just call him the psychiatrist.
He's Kreitzler. He's Kreitzler.
Kreitzler, yes. Yeah. Okay. So Roosevelt and Kreitzler have at Harvard.
Yeah.
They have a fight. Because Sarah asks, well, how did y'all get to know one another?
Yeah.
Right? And how did Roosevelt particularly, you know, get himself attached to Kreitzler? Because it didn't seem
a logical thing. Such a strange pairing.
Yeah, because they're all upper class, though. All four of these people are upper class people.
Well, but, and it's a weird thing to change about Roosevelt from the book and reality to the show is Roosevelt was this performatively tough guy. Like, yeah. Roosevelt himself styled himself as this man's man, this outdoorsman. I mean, it's like Roosevelt, yeah. Teddy Roosevelt is like a human example of performative masculinity, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, the guy they casted him is kind of a weedy dude.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the casting was kind of weird.
It's strange, but, right? Yeah. Because it's the casting, when you think Roosevelt, you think, I know he's not the right age, but you think great big Ted Levine looking guy.
Yeah.
That's who Roosevelt is. And they cast this like really weedy guy, and you need, I mean, it's weirdly, I know it's strange to go to Game of Thrones, but it's like they did with Robert's other brother. There's Stannis and there's, ooh, Renly, right? It's like what they did with Renly in the show, where they made him this weedy, mincing guy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, the whole point of it is it's like that he's the exact same guy as Robert. This big, robust, man's man who, you know, everyone loves and, you know, everyone thinks, oh, well, he'd be a perfect king. It's like, you don't believe that anyone would follow this weedy, like, nervous guy who can't look anyone in the eye and, like, seems very yeah. shifty. Like, why would the whole kingdom love to get behind him, right? Yeah. But in the book, you understand that it's because he's Robert Reborn. He's basically the same looking guy, to the point where, you know, when she sees when she first sees, oh god, it's really bad that I can't remember the illegitimate son's name. Oh, this is terrible.
When she first sees him,
it's like, it looks exactly like Renly. Because again, and here it's the exact same thing. Roosevelt's whole thing is he's this big, beefy man's man who, you know, like goes
has
and he fights in wars and he has six, you know, kids and he went and he, you know, fought in a war just to prove that he could do it.
Yeah.
Like all of that stuff. And here they portray him as this, you know, weedy, borderline ineffectual guy who's getting pushed around by all these cops. And I'm like, that's not who Roosevelt was. And in their three-person group, Roosevelt is supposed to have been the tough guy.
Yeah, and
The tough guy, the smart guy, and the sensitive guy. That was their three-person group. Like, the reporter is the sensitive ladies' man. Roosevelt was the tough guy, and Kreitzler was the brain. Like, that was their three-man organization.
Okay. Now, but let me go back to what I started with.
Please, go.
Okay. Is that in the movie, when Sarah asks how they got together, and
they talk about
reporter guy, right? Our reporter guy tells her the story about how they were going to have this boxing match and it didn't happen, right?
Yeah.
And that's how they became friends, because Roosevelt declined fighting him, right?
Yes.
Because of his arm. That's not what happened in the book.
I didn't think so.
In the book, what happens is Kreitzler fights and Roosevelt beats him up.
Yeah.
Like, he fights. He refuses not to fight.
Yeah.
You know, he insists on having this boxing match.
Despite his condition.
Despite the fact he only has one arm.
And he gets beaten up and everybody respects him.
Everybody respects him for it and they become fast
lifelong friends. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I had thought had happened. And it's weird to change that.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, there are some things that I can understand. I can, like, but some things I don't understand. I mean,
And that's a really weird one, because, like, it essentially means that they become lifelong friends, because you changed the situation so they became lifelong friends because Roosevelt publicly pitied a guy? I don't understand that relationship at all.
And that's not the Kreitzler.
That's not their relationship.
Book, right?
Yeah. That's not who Kreitzler is in the book. And it's, I mean, really, if you think about the Kreitzler of the show, that's not the Kreitzler of the show either. He's still a prideful jerk. You know, in his own way, there's a pridefulness to him and a coldness to him, right? And that is completely...
Okay, I missed you. You kind of got lost
there. Oh, sorry about that. No, I'm saying that there's a pridefulness and a coldness to him in the show, and you don't really believe that someone publicly taking pity on this man would win his lifelong trust. But you would believe from in the book and in the show that, you know, Teddy Roosevelt being willing to, like, respect him enough to beat him up when they were challenged to a fight, like, that would actually
bond the two of
them. Not pitying
him because he only had one arm. Yeah.
Yeah, like, pitying him because he only had one arm, that is not a way that these guys become lifelong friends.
No.
Them actually having a fight and Teddy Roosevelt being willing to show him the respect as a competitor and a boxer, despite his thing, that would bond them for life.
Yeah.
And it does in the book. So you're right. That's a really weird change to make because it badly misrepresents, like, two of the characters. Like, it badly changes two of the characters and totally misrepresents who these people should be. So, yeah, that's a very weird change. And thank you for reminding me of it because I did not remember that part.
Yeah. It's like there were, because I read the book while I was watching it and then I noticed this stuff. I noticed this stuff right away. Like the Sarah stuff, I'm going, why are you making her less of a person than she was in the book? That's number one.
I can offer a theory about that, which I will in a second, but please, you start. But number two.
Number two is the whole Roosevelt-Kreitzler relationship. The real thing that bothered me, right, as well, I guess they wanted to make the bad guy really bad, but why did they have this weird red herring?
Oh. Well, no, and they had the weird red herring because, you know, they needed to stretch it out to 10 episodes or 8 episodes.
But there's enough in the book.
Yeah.
That I think that they could have made it. I mean, the red herring
The red herring is so weird that there's another guy who's really creepy and interacts with kids in the exact same way, and like all of that stuff is it's a surprise. Weird.
The only thing that I can say is that it shows you. Okay, here's my problem with the TV series. Like, I'm going, okay, it does show you that Byrne, right? Yeah. The ex-police chief, the retired police chief, whatever. He got forced out, basically, in the book.
He has been retired. That's clear. They made that clear in the show as well, that he's been retired.
But he is still powerful.
Yeah.
He is still... he is still... And you see his interaction with the powerful people, and so having the red herring being someone who is
part
of the upper classes,
allow you into the world more than the book does,
but it doesn't pay off because you don't get that connected with, because you don't see enough of what Roosevelt is battling with.
That's true.
Like you don't get those things put together.
No.
Like, it would have been better if you could have seen that this was the tension and this was the thing that Roosevelt was fighting.
That's true. It does give a window into that. Again, because we're talking about all of the ways in which we never cut away from the reporter's narration in the book.
Yeah.
It does, that whole relationship does give you a window into just how corrupt they are and just how much this system has been built. And I mean, I say it gives a window into that. Ted Levine just says it. Like, there's no subtlety. Ted Levine has a whole monologue about how we exist. We only have power insofar as we enjoy a lot of power as cops, but it exists only to help, like, to do whatever rich people want.
Cover up for which?
Yeah. To cover up for, well, yeah, but it's like, it exists only insofar as it helps rich people. Like, that's the only reason we have power, and succeeding in helping rich people is the only way we maintain power. And he says that, I mean, I'm saying it less elegantly than he did, but that dialogue exists in the show. There's no subtlety at all about the show's presentation. I mean, nor should there be. Like, I'm not saying it had to be subtle, but, like, the show has to make its themes very clear, and it absolutely does.
Yeah, and that is sort of why they had to bring in that red herring.
Yes.
And then to
be able to make
him...
the themes completely clear in a way that you can't, because in the book, you can have the reporter. Is his name Paul? I feel like it's bad that we're going to...
Okay, call him the reporter all the time. Okay, I've got the book in front of me.
He's got the book right there. So
I've got
I'm just saying, we have his insights in the book, and you can't have that in the show. So in the show, you need, need him to be able to, you need someone else to come in and say these things, and that's what Ted Levine is there to do. To be a window into corruption, to be the guy who can tell us how things are really run.
Yeah.
And I think Ted Levine does a great job, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I think Ted Levine's always great. Like, I've never had a complaint about a Ted Levine performance, I think, ever. But he's really good in this show. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, his name is not Paul, it's John.
John, okay. Well, that's
and
really
Chrysler's
embarrassing.
His name is Laszlo.
Well, that one I did remember. I just go by Chrysler.
It's John.
John,
it's John
thank you.
Schuller Moore.
Ah, okay. There you go. John Schuller Moore.
Yeah.
But yes, you get his insight in the book, as I recall, but you can't have that in the show because it would be, you would have to have him narrating, and that's not what the show wants to do. Like, that's not the world the show is trying to build. So you have to have people in there to talk about the corruption of that world and to let people in a different way. And I think the show does an okay job of it. You're right that it's much less subtle, you know, and it's less of a view into it. I did enjoy Michael Ironside showing up as J.P. Morgan.
Well, we loved Michael Ironside. I was going to bring that up, too. Yeah, it was not so nice to see Michael Ironside.
Wasn't it? Like, I really loved that. Yeah, just having that brief little cameo from Michael Ironside as J.P. Morgan and just the richest man in the world.
Yeah.
And the degree to which...
He controls everything.
And to operate in New York is to operate in the place where this man is king. And if you are doing his bidding, then, you know, you have signed yourself up for a devil's bargain.
Yeah. And which Chrysler refuses to do.
Which he refuses to do. And I mean, it's the smart thing to do because he's J.P. Morgan. And that's the thing. It's like, it's a bad system. Whether or not he wants any specifically evil things done, it's a bad system to take part in.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really good. Also, you get the wonderful scene that was left out of the book of maybe his assistant is just going to go and kill that cop. I mean, I knew he wouldn't because I've read the book, but you get a really nice scene there. When we want revenge for her, for the loss of, oh God, Mary? No, not Mary.
Yeah, it is Mary.
It is Mary. It is Mary. Okay. I was worried I'm getting more names wrong. Ooh.
Yes.
But yeah, that's a very nice scene. You know it's not going to pay off, but it's still a very nice scene.
Well, like, yes.
Maybe
but,
he just
but
goes
he
for
still
revenge.
Gets killed.
Oh, he still gets killed? Well, no,
the evil cop still gets killed.
Yeah, obviously the evil cop's going to get killed. I'm just saying he's not going to get killed. Two episodes from the end. That's just not how television works.
No.
That's
it's
not
all
how you structure
of
a story. It's all part of the big showdown at the end where it's the interesting thing where they continue what he started with the Ted Levine character is Teddy Roosevelt, like part of fixing the police department is retiring these guys, is when these guys get killed in the line of duty. You know, get stabbed in a grog house fight, you give them a hero's funeral, and then you just hire a good person afterwards. Like, you don't... Part of changing the culture, and this is an interesting thing that the show does get into, part of changing the culture is not admitting the culture needs to be changed. Because if you tell people they're part of a corrupt culture, right, they'll recoil against it. They don't want to think of themselves as villains, so they'll recoil against that assessment. And they will fight to keep things as they are because they don't want to admit how bad things are. But if you just talk about how great everything is, and while you're talking about how great everything is, completely change everything. Well, you can get the job done without, you know, without destroying
alienating all sorts of people.
Ah, nice little use of the title there.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
very clever. But yeah, like you without alienating your support. If you don't tell people that you're completely rearranging society, you can do it much more effectively. And I think that's what they're showing you in that last scene where they do give the corrupt, murderous cop a hero's funeral.
Yeah.
You know? They want him to be remembered as one of, you know, the martyrs to the wonderful cause of justice and blah, 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 blah. But it's, and in the end, even though he was corrupt and he was, though he was awful, it's Teddy Roosevelt's justice that he'll wind up being a martyr to. So yeah. His death ends up being a very positive thing.
Yeah.
I mean, not just because he was a horrible person and it's good that he's dead. So...
Yeah, well, he was a horrible person.
Oh, he was a horrible person.
You know, I mean,
he
kills Red Herring, you know.
Oh, yeah, so. He kills Red Herring, and I'm not sad about Red Herring being dead. But, you know, come on. He's a terrible person.
Yes, he was a terrible person.
Yeah, he was a terrible, terrible person. So let's move into the psychology of it. Because, and this is what I really like is about the show. Is, and this is going to sound slightly strange, but bear with me, that I'm not saying it's saying that profiling is useless, because it's not. It is actually kind of useful in this show, right? And what interested me about the way they show profiling is we make all these jokes about how they never use profiling, but it's so crazy that this show is set in a time when the idea of there being a type of person who committed a crime really doesn't exist.
Well, no, they were just, I mean, they just all believed that people were born.
Yeah, people were born. They are who they are. And yeah. Crime exists only, like, murders. Like, yes, there are people who murder for profit. There are people who murder because it will help with a business deal, right? And there are people who murder because they get angry at somebody, like in the moment they are angry, but those are the only two kinds of murders that exist. Like what would come to be called the lust murder doesn't exist in anyone's head at the time,
right?
And that's what I like about the show's treatment. It's like that this really, the book addresses it and the show addresses it, and it is literally that people can't understand the concept of a murder that either isn't because you were mad or because there was some profit for you in it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what I really liked about the show, because that's what murder was actually like.
Yeah.
Like, that's what murder investigation was. Like, you can either you were mad at someone, or you had something to gain by the murder. There was no conception that someone would murder just because they wanted to murder.
Yeah.
And
or they were compelled.
They needed to, yes.
To murder. Right. Just to murder, to resolve some internal...
Exactly, yes. I guess that is the better thing.
Yeah.
Like, the motivation exists entirely within their own head in a way that we can't understand, because we're not inside their head.
Their head, yeah.
Yeah, and that is something that baffled psychologists for ages and ages and ages. And my favorite part about Mindhunter, the book here, not the TV show, is him taught is like that the biggest thing he says that profilers had to do was go across the country testifying in court to make people understand that yes, some people kill other people just because they want to kill other people, just because they have to kill other people, not because there's anything in it for them, not because that person did anything to them. They do it just because it's what they do. And honestly, Alienist is set at a time where we were 40 years away from understanding that. And that's why I almost call it the steampunk psychology, is because he's getting there so much faster than everyone else did in real life.
Yes. So much faster.
Yeah.
And I mean, the book is, I would suggest, like, you can watch both of these.
Yeah.
Because I think, you can read the book and you can watch the
value.
They're both really actually good. I mean, it's a strange
it's weird, because you can point out changes that annoyed you, but at the same time, like, it's not a bad, it's like, there are changes that annoyed you, and we've pointed out a couple of places where changes made the characters worse and less interesting.
Yeah.
That is true. And I know why they did it, and in most cases, like, it was, actually, sometimes I don't know why they did it.
Yeah.
I don't know why they,
I
know why they did it with her, right? I know they did it because they wanted, they think that people will not obviously have more sympathy with a female character than with a male character. Like, you will more want to experience her emotions, ergo, if she is shocked by this world, the audience will be shocked by this world. In a way, they don't think that the audience will be shocked and sympathetic by this world if it's just Luke Evans experiencing it for the first time. That's what they think. And I don't think they're right. I think Luke Evans could have pulled that off. And
I think he could have,
He could have, and I think he could have carried that, and I think it actually does a better thing for their relationship.
Yeah.
If he comes to if he respects her, if he grows to respect her, seeing how much more together she is in this world, as compared to him, because that's more how it plays in the book. So I think that was a mistake, and I think the Teddy Roosevelt thing was a mistake, but the show has the advantage that the book doesn't have of, as we've talked about, giving you this look into the world of the rich and powerful, right, when they're alone. You know, book can't do.
No, the book doesn't do that.
No.
For sure.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't, there's no room to it. And then, so, yeah, there are smart changes they make and there are dumb changes they make. But I don't think any of the changes they make invalidate the TV show or make it bad.
No, no, no. I would definitely recommend the TV show.
Yeah.
You know, but the psychology thing, like, it's really interesting how they're, how they do it. Like, I don't think the TV show, and it can't manage it the way the book does. And I it just can't, right? Yeah. Because in the book, right, what you have, and I don't think the TV show necessarily could have handled the hours that they spend. Like, they make some changes. Like, I liked seeing the Franz Boas character, right?
Yes.
But that was nice. And but in the TV show, you make things antagonistic.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why they did that either.
Well, no,
like,
and I mean, it's
plays, whereas in the book, there's no antagonism there. No,
they're all working together to solve a problem.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, they don't have to make, it's almost as if in 2018 or whatever, 17 or 15, everybody says you have to have antagonism.
Well, no, they do. And I mean, this is, you're pointing out a very real problem in a lot of writing, which is people think, oh, well, essentially screenwriters will tell you there has to be tension in every scene and there has to be conflict in every scene.
Yeah.
And what writers do is they're like, well, let's have people bickering at each other all the time.
Yeah.
It's a real issue that, like, a lot of writers do. And that's the way they interpret there has to be conflict in every scene. But honestly, like, the conflict is literally just these people, learning that the world doesn't work the way they thought it did. It's John's eyes being opened to what crime is really like and what people are really like.
Yeah.
Right? And that is a conflict. But the way they've decided to add quote-unquote drama to the scenes is have everybody yelling at each other about this.
Yeah. Have conflict where you didn't really need to have conflict. No.
Like, they all understand the stakes and they're all working on this together. I think a lot of it, you're right, is false conflict.
Yeah, because the only real conflict in the book is when they go to the census guy.
Yes.
You know, because they finally figured out that they can find this guy because of the census.
And that's the interesting thing, is it comes down to a process of elimination kind of.
Yeah.
Of what do you call it, investigation, where it's like, okay, well, who are the kinds of people who have access to this world?
Yeah.
Right.
And easily have access to this world. Who can go and talk to
anybody? Yeah. Yeah. And you will never be surprised seeing this guy around. You will never be shocked if he wants to talk to your children. Like, who is someone that people legally have to trust implicitly because they're told to give all of their information to him? Yeah. And the one thing they come up with is, well, if he's not a nurse and he's not a criminal in that world, then he's a census taker.
Yeah.
And you know, that logic, and they follow a completely logical trail of deduction to get there.
Yep.
To the point where it's like, why he does it is fascinating, but in the end, and this is what I was making that joke about profiling, why he doesn't help you, doesn't help you catch him. How he does it, like how he gets there, is how you catch him. How he fits into that world. That's how you catch him. Why he does it is interesting, but it's not how you catch people.
Well, and I think that this show, to some extent...
You think it understands that?
I think the show does understand that. It's because it's more a curiosity in some ways that they want to find out why he did this, and they think that it will help.
Right.
But, you know, because they don't know what else to do to try and find this guy, right?
It's
and
true.
Then, you know, and why he's like what he's doing, right? It's weird. So they do have to go and kind of track the trail. Because if they don't have this guy's name,
right? No, though, you're
right.
The
only way they have this guy's name
is because they followed the psychological trail.
The psychological thing. Boaz says, yeah, you know, this looks like sort of Indian stuff. Yeah. But no, this is why the Sioux would do this. And no, they would never do that. And definitely they would never do it to a child.
Yeah.
So consequently,
because it was about disgracing an enemy warrior is what he says.
Yeah. And then only if you didn't like the warrior.
Oh, exactly.
You know? Like,
yeah,
you might do this to Custer, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, you're not going to do it.
Fought someone when you beat in a fair fight. Yeah.
Okay. So what happens is
that's a really good point.
So they did.
The psychology does factor into that.
Yeah, trying to understand what he did, and they're clueless in the beginning, like okay, and they get little kinds of clues. You know, it still doesn't make too much sense, but they can at least follow once they have a name. Right?
Yeah, they can use the standard, like, they can use these investigative techniques.
Yeah,
once they find out that he's going by this other man's name.
Yeah, the census thing. And then when they go back and they find that he's killed his parents, and then they talk to the brother, and the brother tells them how this man had been sexually abused when he was a boy.
Hey, his brother, Johnny Crowder from Justified.
Yeah.
He's great seeing Johnny Crowder from Justified.
Right, so...
And I really liked the scene with his brother where the authorities have shown up and there's this undercurrent that's like, well, if you come in contact with the authorities, you might get murdered.
Yeah.
That's subtext to the whole scene where it's like, he seems genuinely afraid that they're there to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because no one has a good experience talking with the authorities in this day and age. I really liked that. But anyway, please continue. You're saying that you're right. Like, unless you follow all of the why he did it, maybe they don't get that name.
Yeah, maybe they just don't get his name. Because
if they can't figure out... Because you're right. And I think the why, that's where the why is most important. And it's right there at the start. Because you're saying, okay, the Indians, right? Like the Indian fighting, as they called it at the time, that was going on. That's what these wounds most resemble. But they don't look like the things that were actually done. I mean, and this is, by the way, there's historical precedence to this, by the way. Like that comes from the actual investigation of Jack the Ripper. They saw how the bodies were mutilated, and the news was always full of stories about bodies mutilated by Indians because they friggin' love stories about that in England. And Wild Bill's show was in England at the time. So they they followed this theory that maybe the killer is a, and this is, you know, the terminology that they used, a red savage let loose on the streets of London. There's actual news stories suggesting that from the time. And that's where this comes from. And of course, it had nothing to do with that, but that is the new story. And the police actually went and investigated, you know, Wild Bill's Wild West show. Like, they did do that. Right? Sorry, not Wild Bill. Wild Bill Hickok. Buffalo Bill Cody is who I'm talking about. Not Wild Bill Hickok. His Wild West show. Sorry about that. That was embarrassing. But yes, Buffalo Bill Cody and his Wild West show. And what's so fascinating about it is that is what they're referencing here in the show, is the belief that it could have been that. You see brutality, and the first thing is, well, who are the quote-unquote savages who appear in the media? Oh, well, let's look that avenue. And where the psychology becomes really interesting, as you point out, is they, okay, well, if this wasn't a native that did this, why would someone, like, there would have to be a reason to associate your crimes with them. And that is what follows them to the quote-unquote Indian fighters hospital. And they find out about the dead guy who they thought fit all of their things. But then they find out the dead guy had a friend, and boom, there you go.
Well, what's interesting, of course, the one thing in the book is that, of course, Beecham, as he was known by then, didn't actually see fighting in the Indian War. It's, and they make that clear. It's not like, like sometimes the book isn't as clear. I mean, the TV show isn't as clear. As the book, but it's, I mean, it doesn't matter because they eventually get
us there.
To the photographs. They're clearer that it's the photographs that his father took.
Exactly. Oh, no, and that's the thing. It's like, because he, Beecham, he had just heard the stories. And it's weird because they actually have it, it's almost a cheat because they have him get there twice. Because it's really his father's obsession with this brutality.
Yeah.
That made him fixated on it. And I guess they're saying the fact that he also then met an Indian fighter is what double reinforced that idea in his head. It's like, that's what that he actually went to that hospital and met an Indian fighter and heard his stories is what reinforced that awfulness.
That's not in the book.
No, that's not in the book. No, no, no. They needed to be clear in the show. Like, they needed you to be able to understand. And it's like, okay, well, here's this guy.
And like, I think that part of that might have been, okay, sometimes there are things you just can't show, and maybe, you know, it's not Criminal Minds after all, so we're not going to show the brutality and the photographs, the old daguerreotypes. I mean, it might have been really expensive to have created those photographs
It wouldn't have been expensive at all. No, they could absolutely do that in a TV show.
But I think maybe there was some kind of a reason why they, or maybe
just
they thought,
wanted to keep it off the show. I mean, honestly, you might have just thought it was so unpleasant you didn't want to put it on television.
Yeah.
And I would respect them if that was the case.
Because basically you don't see any of that, right?
No, you don't see it.
So, and I think that they did want to keep it, you know, not triple X rated for violence.
Yes. Yeah, not excessively brutal.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bad, but it's one thing to see a cadaver in a mortuary,
an autopsy setting, and more to see these essentially snuff porn photographs.
Yeah.
That's a very different feel.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this is the key part. And what I love about how they solved the crime is the problem that people still have today. Because fundamentally, they are able to solve this crime because they say, okay, well, have there been any other murders around like this?
Yeah.
And they're able to search state records and search newspapers. And it's like, and that is something that I believe them when the show tells us that it wouldn't occur to cops to do, because of their ideas that motives could only be profit or anger. Well, no, then you're not going to search all of these other types of crimes, are you? If that's all you think murder is.
Yeah.
And so I love the scene where they're like, well, let's just go through the records and see if anyone else has been killed like this. And you know what? Lo and behold, they find the parents of the killer.
Yeah. And it works, you know.
It totally works.
Thing is that I think what you don't get to is just how long it took them to do this.
Yeah.
In the book, it takes forever.
Well, and that's one of my biggest problems with the show, right?
Yeah, they imbue themselves in psychology.
Yes.
Chrysler makes all of them read all of this psychology stuff.
And there's bits of that in the show because they always have the books around and they talk about the stuff they're reading. But in the book, it is explicit the amount of homework these people are having to do to work on this case. And how,
difficult it is to understand. See, this is why the book makes more sense, and you can believe that maybe these people would have kind of thought of these things, because there's always been outliers in the world, right? So these people were just a bunch of outliers. Nobody wanted to believe them. Nobody wanted to accept what they said.
But
they're reading all of this, the French stuff and the German stuff. So they're reading
the people who were doing these deep dives into how the mind works.
And they're reading Jensen, and they're reading all of these guys who in the second half of the 19th century are coming up, are using hypnosis, are using, you know, Mesmer even, but are using
all of these theories to try and explain human behavior. And
and they're all getting us there. Freud had to change his friggin' mind, right?
Yeah. Well, Freud got it, but then he had to pretend he didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, and I think he believed he didn't get it.
You're right. He did. I say pretend. I mean, he did, like, if he was just pretending, he would not have wrote all of the books he wrote. That's true.
Yeah. I think that he persuaded himself that
he had been wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right about that. I'm being too cynical. I'm ascribing cynical motivation.
No, like, I think he ended up believing. But, I mean, what was interesting in the book is that they do bring up, you know, okay, yeah, but Freud said. And, of course, what's happening is that this entire case proves what Freud said.
Oh, yeah.
In the first place.
Proves Freud's original belief about child abuse creating these things.
Yeah, and of course, and Sarah's the one who says yes, but he's recently changed his mind. And I think it's interesting because he changes his mind, like, you know, around that time.
Yeah.
But he changes his mind
because of the social and financial pressures that are realized in the show. That we see them. And so it's weird that they would leave that out of the, you know, now that you describe it that way, I find it actually a little weird they would leave it out of the show, because Freud understanding this stuff about the human mind and being forced to change it because society, you know, because rich Vienna society would not accept his answers really does fit in with all of the brutal how the world
everything
works stuff
that's
in the show.
Going on in that world.
Yeah, weird. You know what? Now that you say that, I had forgotten that part of the book, but it actually makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. The only thing is that when I think about it, I'm going, I'm not sure how you would fit it in. It would be a different TV series.
To be able to fit in all of that stuff
about
the psychology.
Like, to put all of that stuff. But he makes them, Chrysler makes these, the two policemen.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, that's another thing. So now we have to have the one cop, right? The younger cop. Yes. Having a romantic relationship and being a communist.
Yeah.
That's not in the book at all. And that
of course,
was just
that's
a bunch
not in
of
the
crap.
Book. I know. They needed to give him something to do. But you're right. It was not great.
I mean, that was just like the lamest part of the TV show.
The entire show was the side
plot about
him. Because
there's no payoff in it.
No, and that's the frustrating part, is there's no payoff to his flirting with communism and having an affair with a young widow. Like, there's no payoff to that. Yeah. Oh, no, not a young widow. Her husband leave her, or is she a widow? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember whether she's a widow or whether she just got knocked up.
Yeah. Or no, I think she was because I think she had been married. But your point is, yes.
But it's not clear that, like, because of the time, like, you don't have a time constraint. I know it's sort of, but I'm going, when I see that first, that little baby, I'm going, I'm not sure that it's not his baby.
I know. Well, it's not, but yes.
I know
because of the unclear timeline in which the show is set. Yes.
You know, it's very, very unclear. Well, on
and that's the weird
show.
Part is
and
the
there's
show...
no payoff.
Well, yeah, there's, no, there's payoff. No payoff to that relationship at all.
His
and
brother
honestly...
says, but you love her.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, well, I'm not ready. Well, give me a payoff. Give me something better than that.
Honestly, it's possible that, you know, that was laid in for if they did a second season, because there's a sequel book. Okay. I haven't read the sequel book, by the way.
Oh, maybe. Okay.
Have you read it?
I didn't even know there was a second book.
Okay, well, you're finding out now. Yeah.
I mean, way behind. Well, my life started.
It's set like, I think it's
Hell
I don't
in
know,
the Handbasket in the late
yeah,
90s.
Around that
so.
Time, so. No, yeah. No, you did not know. Well, I did. I mean, I didn't know for years. It's literally just DM that told me that there had been a second book. And I'm like, really? Oh. And I should ask her whether they can base. Whether, like, there's the material there to base a second season of the show on, or whether it doesn't really fit. But, I mean, probably it would. I assume it's about the same character.
Oh, wait a minute, The really Alienist sequel. Season 2?
Oh, then maybe they
release
are.
Date, cast, plot, and everything. Okay.
Okay,
so
yeah,
maybe...
they're doing a season 2. All right, so maybe... So we're going to give them a hold up. We're going to hold back and say we don't know for sure whether that whole relationship... Jewish maybe. Guy gets into communism thing is going anywhere, because they might that might pay off in season 2.
There might actually be yes.
Okay, so there's a probably going to be a season 2. All right, so we're gonna take a wait and see. And if it is based on the second book, I will go and I will read the second
it
book.
It is. It's called I've got it up here on Digital Spy.
Okay. Okay.
So it'll be based on the sequel. The Angel of Darkness. The plan is to retitle the entire show after the book. So they'll entire. Oh. It'll be
season
the
season two is going to be called The Angel of Darkness. Okay.
Yeah. And Frank
Pugliese
is going to be the showrunner.
Did he run the first season?
Nope. I don't think so. No.
New showrunner for the second season. Oh, that's interesting. But we'll see. But what matters to me, though, and this is, I think, the key thing. Is that I think fundamentally, like, we get enough of the, like, understanding how the world worked in the show, and I think this is what makes it good, to say that just doing a good investigation, like, just doing real, what we now think of as police work, was strange enough at the time to be rebellious, like, to seem like you were in rebellion and you were rocking the boat, and... I think the show does a good job of capturing that. And because that's the thing. For someone who doesn't understand how the police worked at the time and how New York worked at the time, the idea that their giant, like, revelation is to actually investigate a crime might seem contrived. It might seem strange, right?
Yeah.
But I think the show does a good enough job of explaining just how corrupt and how blinkered this world was to make it seem, to make you understand that it really was a revelation and they really were mavericks just for actually investigating a crime instead of just saying, you know, some goons did it and everybody going home.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the business with the fingerprints, right?
Yes, that
or
was
as
nice
they
touch.
Say in Murdoch Mysteries, finger marks.
Finger marks. Oh yeah, and I think they actually might say finger marks one time here.
Yeah,
because that is an early term they used for it.
Yeah, and how it wasn't accepted, and
we've talked, and it wasn't for a long time. Like they had to do a massive like court battles to decide that if this would be accepted as evidence in court, and eventually it was, and that's great. But it was a fight.
Yeah.
And the Bertillon system. But the other thing that really interested me, though, and this is what I thought, the biggest, I mean, we've talked about the flaws of the show, but I will say that you brought this up, and I think you're right. If not the biggest, then really close to the biggest problem the show has is never, it doesn't do a good job of letting us feel how much time has passed. It really doesn't. Like, you have no idea how much time is passing for these characters when you watch this show. Mm-hmm. And that's a real problem. Like, it's a real problem because they're changing as people as they learn about this world, like what the world is really like. And you just don't get the depth of how long and how profound these changes are
when
you're watching the show.
Yeah. And you know what? And you know what? One of the things they could have done, instead of having, in, you said they had the red herring to fill up time. And I'm going, you know, maybe you could have shown the two brothers as on the train a little bit more as they're going out. Like it seems like they get out to.
I know, it's so weird that like the show the West jumps in a day. Over. Yeah, like literally, while a day's worth of events are happening back in New York, they go to the West and back. You know?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like no. You know how long it took by train?
Oh yeah, it took. You weeks know, it wasn't. To get out
these
there.
Were steam engines.
Yeah. No, these are going at top. Like, oh my God, this amazing train going 40 miles an hour.
An hour. I mean, horses could run beside trains back in those days.
Absolutely. Still. And it's like that. And, you know, and they had to slow down for every turn. And they stopped in every town along the way to pick up water and more coal and to deliver the mail. Like, getting anywhere was an ordeal back then. And yeah, you would have to devote an entire episode just to that trip. And you could show that a huge amount of time was passing for the people back in New York while they were off getting this information. But we have them do the whole trip out west in the time it takes for them to have like three conversations back in New York.
Yeah, and Dakota Fanning, so Sarah's, right?
Yeah.
Sarah's journey when she goes to that town, right? It's not that fast either. She has to stay there overnight. And, you know, this whole thing, and she meets someone else there, like that she's talking to, and it's a very, and she goes out right to the, she goes out to see the burned down house and the totally collapsed house now, and that's she's the one that finds the pictures, and like she has a much more important and relevant role in the book. She is by far. Right.
Oh, no, she's the character who is done worst by in the adaptation.
In the adaptation. I agree with that.
She's really not a terrible character here, but she was a much better character in the book. It's still a good part. She still does interesting stuff. But you're right. She was a much better character in the book.
Yeah. Well, and I'm reading. I'm looking at something in Digital Spy, and it says here, somebody says, and let's hope that Dakota Fanning gets a more comfortable costume to wear this time out as she... apparently genuinely fainted on season one because of her outfit. But I'm
they had her
sorry.
In the corset.
Those clothes were wonderful.
No, she looked fantastic. But
she looked fantastic in those clothes.
But like, those like corsets were not comfortable to wear.
Late 19th century. So they didn't have to tighten them as much as, you know.
I know, yeah.
Because like, she continued to wear
them a little better to not wear and not, you know, actually, you know, bind her in with the corset. That would have been a solution. Just tailor them a little better. Oh, no, we had to be 100% realistic with the agony these women suffered. I'm like, I don't think you did, though.
No,
I don't think you did have to be 100% realistic with that.
And particularly since Sarah had been living on her own for quite a while. Her father had committed suicide. Her mother had died of cancer. Her father committed suicide when she was in her late teens.
Yeah, and she has been a much more independent woman.
She's a much stronger person, and here you get this. She's the worst done by in the entire
in the adaptation. I would agree with that completely. And one thing I will say though is the there is this weird bit in the book. In the show, that a timeline thing that I really didn't understand at all, which is. So they go up and they do the investigation, right? They talk to Johnny Crowder, they do the investigation. And then on the way back, they're attacked by assassins, right?
Yeah.
And then it's like, they just cut to them being back in New York. And I'm like, I feel like it would be more of an ordeal to get home since there were assassins on your trail.
Like, and in the book, it does take them more time.
Yes. And they get back like, 8 hours later, like, your coachman got killed, the thing crashed, and it's like, as far as we can tell, you get home, and, you know, while they're gone, Mary's murdered, and it's horrible, and I get, like, the timing of that all works out, except for the fact that it only takes them, they get back relatively quickly after all of that happened, and I'm like, maybe the intent of that scene is it took them longer to get home, but the show does not portray it that way. It really does seem like they get home right after, like, yeah, a couple of hours, like, after they were another, attacked in upstate New York.
There was a house down the road
that also had a carriage that could just take them to New York.
Yeah, very quickly. And, there were a few little
of time compression things. Examples, yeah, of time compression that just don't really make sense.
And you don't get this. The funny thing is right, is that when you're reading the book, you get a real sense of who this person is.
Yeah.
Like, who's the murderer.
Right.
And I think what you don't really get, they should have just left out the friggin' red herring.
I know, and spent more time with the actual killer.
Because the more we talk about this, I'm going, because what happens is that this man is extremely powerful when he's killing and up high.
Yeah.
He loses his facial tic. He loses everything. And all of that is kind of lost. Like there's a whole bunch of things about him. Mm-hmm. That get lost as they're going through the sewers.
Yeah.
Because in the book, it doesn't end in the sewers.
No.
It ends up high.
Yeah.
And you get this, and of course, like, I'm trying
to
remember.
You see the complete transformation of him as a person, right? In the show, he just gets shot, and then he...
Yeah.
And then we go back to the... And then he crawls up high to die, and that's the end of the show.
Whereas
in the book, you're right, we see the whole confrontation up top, so we can get how he really is a totally different person when he's killing.
Yeah, totally and completely different.
Yeah, he is transformed.
Yeah.
And when you see that he is transformed by murder, well, you can understand that his regular life is so agony that, of course, he needs to keep feeling like the person he does when he's killing.
Yeah.
Like, he's desperate to keep that going. Yeah, and it is sad that they lost that.
Yeah.
That was a mistake.
And I think that what happens to, like, with Caleb Carr, like, as I said, you can watch it, but there are powerful things in the book
That are left out.
And as I said, just get rid of the red herring and you could have worked some of that stuff.
Had the time. Yeah, you could have had time to fit that in. So I will say that I think we can recommend the show.
Oh, yeah.
I think
recommend
absolutely
the show.
People should watch the show. But really, you should read the book. If you liked the show at all, there's more in the book. And the book has a ton of stuff the show was missing and is, in its own way, like, more. It is a better book than it is a show.
Yeah.
But it is a good show that's absolutely worth watching.
Yeah, it's a good show worth watching. And what I would say is that I didn't feel like I was rehashed. That was the funny thing, because I found The Alienist because you told me, oh, you don't have to read the book, Mom. We'll just talk about that. And then I was, because I'm doing cleaning and doing stuff, right? All of a sudden I'm going, oh shit,
turns it up,
copy,
like, it's
of
perfect.
The Alienist. Okay, so I'll start reading it. And I didn't feel like I was doing a rehash. The book is powerful. I mean, Caleb Carr really wrote a good book for something that was set in the 19th century and is, you would almost think it's slow, but it's not. It doesn't feel slow because Carr is such a powerful writer. I mean, his descriptions of those tenements, his descriptions of that bar where they, like, I have more visuals in my head from the book
than I do from the movie.
The movie.
Yeah.
Like, because I had to sit there and think, but they didn't do any of that in the movie. And in the TV series.
The TV show.
But I have this power, like, when they go into this horrible, god-awful bar.
Yeah.
In
you think because, about it. Yeah.
And that's Lucius and his brother, you know, trying to find the knife, right? The person, you know, and where this guy is living.
What kind of knife was used and where he was living,
You know, and stuff like that. Like, it's very visceral. The book is really actually...
They do a great job of, again, putting you there.
Yeah, putting you there. When I first started it, it's, again, you know, it's a little slow, but all of a sudden, right? And the Sarah character is really, I think my only takeaway is that the Sarah character is not well done by.
And oh, my question to you is, you mentioned something to me. So were they Irish mobsters in the book?
There were Irish mobsters in the book.
Yeah, that are left out of the show. And Paul, oh, that Italian was it.
I said that to you. How the hell is Paul Kelly Italian?
Yes, that's it.
That was it. I
had forgotten about that.
They kept his name in
the... They kept the name, but they made him an Italian guy, which is crazy.
It was an Italian mob guy. I'm sitting here going...
Did they... It's honestly like they were worried about confusing the audience if all of the mobsters were were Irish. Which is true, by the way, which is true
of New York.
Of New York at the time. All of the mobsters were Irish, and the mobsters stayed Irish for a really long time.
Yeah, the Italians didn't move in.
There were Italians, but the mob didn't move in until much later.
Yeah, well, yeah, after the First World War, I think.
Yeah, it's well after the time of this book is set that the Irish mob starts having its wars and being supplanted by the Italian mob.
Yeah, because
it's much after.
Everybody needs to go read a book called The Madonna of 54th Street or something
like that. Yeah, it's about the Catholics.
It's about the Catholic
Italian Catholics in the experience in the ghettos of New York. And it's a very interesting book. So, but yes, such a weird thing for them to like change. Honestly, that is just them. I mean, I'm not going to say estimating correctly or underestimating whatever, but that is them thinking their audience won't be able to understand the concept of Irish gangsters running New York.
Well, is this why Ripper Street didn't last very long?
Maybe.
Because it was the Irish mob, eh? I mean, after the Civil War in New York.
Maybe. All right. So before we go, before we recommend people check out the something else, I will. I want to tell the one celebrity story I always tell when he comes up because I think it's so charming. I have a celebrity story about Luke Evans that is my favorite celebrity story, and it's not my story. It didn't happen to me. But when I heard it, I'm like, I've never been so charmed by a thing. And that is, so I know a person who was working on the special effects for the movie Three Musketeers. And it's possible no one remembers the movie Three Musketeers because it was the Paul W.S. Anderson version, that nobody saw. Basically, the funny thing about Paul Anderson is he made Resident Evil and he made a lot of money making Resident Evil. He made all of those movies. And so he got into his head, I'll make a bunch of other video game movies and make money. And no one would give him the rights to make other video game movies. And who knows? It's a weird fact. So he produced and he directed. And so he desperately wanted to make a movie based on Dead Space and they wouldn't give him the rights to do it. So he and another guy wrote a fake Dead Space movie and that's the movie Pandorum. And then he tried desperately to get the rights to Assassin's Creed and no one would give him the rights to it. So he made the movie Three Musketeers. And this is just how the little backstory of how that movie happened. And so the guy I know was running 3D scanning. So basically, if you want to make a 3D model of someone for special effects shots, you have to do a full body 3D scan of them, right? In crazy high definition laser scan to get every detail of their body. And then you turn that body into a 3D model that you animate. And that's how you do special effects, right? Okay. And so Luke Evans was there doing his 3D scanning in various costumes. And he sees the team that it's doing it. And he's like, hey, were you guys the same 3D scanning team on the movie Immortals? And this was the movie that he had been in about Greek mythology.
Right.
And they were like, yes, we were that team. And he's like, okay, I just want to tell you that I just want to say right now, I want to apologize for how I behaved on that movie. And I don't know if I said anything horrible to you, but there's a good chance I did. I spent that entire movie with my shirt off. And basically, when you met me, I had not eaten any food in 6 months. So I don't know if I said anything horrible to you, but if I did, I just want to apologize and say I absolutely behaved unacceptably for that entire movie shoot. I'm like, what a nice thing to do.
What a nice thing to do.
To remember that it was the same people 4 years later and apologize for something he might have done. Like, I don't know anything about Luke Evans as a person, but when I hear that, I'm like, well, he's probably okay. And it's like, I had already liked his performance, but after I heard this story, I'm like, well, now I'm just a fan of Luke Evans. Going forward. All right, so that has been our check-in between seasons 10 and 11 of Criminal Minds, which raises the big question, what's the homework for next week?
Oh,
you didn't bring it up. I thought you had it.
Just
ready.
A moment.
That's my fault.
Bring it up.
She's
going to
bring
up
the synopsis.
Criminal Minds, season 11.
Okay. We're going to watch episodes 1 through 3 next week. And here's how little I remember about this, despite having watched all of these episodes this year to write the reviews. I don't remember if Aisha Tyler's in the first episode.
Well, let's find out.
I'm very excited to find out.
Okay. It was announced that Aisha Taylor will replace Hewitt in recurring roles.
Yeah, because she didn't get into the opening credits until the end of the season.
And then AJ Cook revealed herself to be pregnant.
Yeah, because it's like when she was pregnant, the end of the last season, I'm like, okay.
Okay, so now, okay. The only way to find out if she was in the first
season. Well, no, we're just
going to
watch
IMDb.
It. It's fine. No, you don't have to go to. We're going to watch the episodes. I'm saying, I don't remember.
Okay.
You don't have to look it up.
The first one is.
Please.
The Job.
Oh, God. The first. Oh, we are going to have so much to talk. Yeah, of course, the first episode is the one kicking off the assassin storyline. What else was it going to be?
Yes.
It has to kick off the assassin. All right. I feel very
silly.
Oh, yeah.
So Tara is there. Yes.
Yeah. Tara's there in the first episode. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The first episode is The Job. What is The Witness? That's the second episode? The Witness?
Yes.
Which episode is that, may I ask?
10 civilians die in a sarin gas attack on a Los Angeles, California commuter bus.
Right. The one with Cho from The Mentalist. Yep. Yeah. Got it.
And then the third one is Till Death Do Us Part.
I have no idea what episode that is.
When two brides-to-be are found dead.
Oh, okay. The obsessive lady in the flower shop. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, right. I remember that one.
Oh, no, I remember the episode. It's just the title didn't jump out at me. Okay, so yeah, that's what we're going to be watching next week. So next Thursday, join us back here for that. I was about to ask, do we have anything running in corollary with that? But then I realized, no, it's after season 11. We're going to be watching Beyond Borders for the first time. And the first few weeks of season 12, you're going to be hearing us talk about Beyond Borders.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There
may be the odd bonus episode every now and then.
Depending on what we watch on television and what shows up in theaters, there might be a bonus episode. Again, we're recording this 8 months in advance, so we don't know what we're going to have seen and watched between now and then, but it's going to be pretty fun. And in fact, I was about to say, maybe we've already talked about The Alienist season 2, because if The Alienist season 2 airs, we might want to do an, I just realized that if The Alienist season 2 airs between now and when this episode airs, we might want to do a timely episode talking about Alienist season 2, which would create a weird situation where we have to. Like, we're thinking that this is going to be the episode that goes between season 10 and 11. We might actually release this episode early to coincide with us talking about Alienist season 2 in bonus episodes. So, yeah, that's something that had never occurred to me before. But, all right, that might end up happening.
And we're going to watch Prodigal Son, so.
Exactly. So, like, we've got a bunch of bonus stuff coming, so be on the lookout for that, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And if this ended up airing way before we talked about season 11, we will have cut all of this and you're never going to hear it. So who am I talking to? If it doesn't, though, join us back here next Thursday for the start of Criminal Minds season 11. We hope. And in other news, if you'd like to get in touch with us, if you have any questions, suggestions, if you have any profiling relating fiction for us to check out that you think would be good to cover on the show, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. So thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week. But until then, au revoir.
And I just want to say thank you to our 5-star review on iTunes and let you know that you should have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.